Well, good morning, TNC family, on this second Sunday in June. Today, we move to book number 2 in our annual summer series centered around authors and their brand new scholarship surrounding biblical theology and the life of faith. You may want to pause this and check out at least the beginning of last week's episode if you want a fuller description of the series. And just a reminder that the book list we released over a month ago, and you can still check it out on our website or at the weekend service. But let's jump in now to today's book, written by Beth Moore. And as a springboard for the conversation, just listen now to these sentences from page 14. All my knotted up life, I've longed for the sanity and simplicity of knowing who's good and who's bad. And I've wanted to know this about myself as much as anyone. And all my knotted up life, I've needed God to clean up the mess, divide the room, and sort the mail so all of us can just get on with it, be who we are, make it through life. And what I thought would help me make it was for people to be one thing or the other, good or bad. But as benevolent as God has been in a myriad of ways, God has remained aloof on this uncomplicated request. Beth Moore probably needs very little introduction. She's a Christian superstar, for lack of a better word, and I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just her books have sold millions and millions of copies. She has filled stadiums for decades at weekend ministry and faith-based conferences. Churches across the world use her Bible study curriculum in their small groups. She was born in 1957, grew up in Arkansas, is the 4th of 5 children, raised Southern Baptist, and her brand new book is called All My Knotted Up Life, a Memoir. And in it, she describes her own, and by extension, the all knotted up lives of pretty much every human she's ever met. And so, for example, she talks about growing up poor. 2 parents, 4 siblings, 1 grandmother and her, all living together in a small house, sharing bedrooms, bathrooms, and beds with never a penny to spare. Finances, all knotted up. And she talks about racism and growing up being taught that black and white children don't play together. And her grandmother watching she and her siblings play outside, watching from the picture window inside their home, worried that if they crossed the street and ran into a boy with deep brown skin, they would get molested. And she writes about going to movie theaters where for 70 cents a piece, anyone was welcome. Whites were welcome to take the official entrance with the doorman and sit downstairs in the main auditorium. And blacks were also welcome to enter a separate door with no doorman and buy their tickets and treats at the back of the concessions and then follow the colored signs and climb a set of narrow stairs to the balcony. All knotted up ideas of ethnicity and race. And she talks about sexual abuse and specifically being sexually abused by her own father and how it led to a long season of instability afterwards, quote, making D's in classes, no longer a people person, not being able to even look people in the eye, and the start of a season of life with no shortage of boyfriends and no tools for handling them. I was a good girl doing bad things. I was a bad girl doing good things. I was spiraling in our spinning house, all knotted up. And she talks about trying to start over, but there being no real starting over from scratch in life. There's just starting over scratched and scarred. And she talks about witnessing her parents' horrible marriage, a marriage almost entirely lived in a state of shambles. Quote, I still daydream. Still, from time to time, about what our lives might have been like if Mom had left Dad. I thought about it incessantly the week our whole family celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary. But my mom did what many women of her era did. She stayed, despite a dozen valid reasons to go. She considered taking her own life, but never leaving Dad. And she talks about how she has been treated badly by Christian men and denominational leaders who joke that her husband must not be the man of the house. Rather, it's she who leads him. Quote, throughout my life, I frequently read and heard men say, can you imagine what it would be like to be her husband? And she talks about how she got hate mail and threats when she spoke out against the way Donald Trump spoke about touching women and treating women, and how she, in all her life, has never seen anything in the U.S. that she found more astonishingly seductive and dangerous to the people of God than Trumpism. And she talks about her own very challenging marriage and the days and nights where she lived and slept, quote, in a house with a stranger, a man I didn't like and who didn't like me. Yet, she talks throughout the book how they've worked hard and stayed faithful, and today her husband of 45 years, Keith, is her absolute best friend, and they remain deeply in love. And she talks about leaving her lifelong love, the Southern Baptist denomination, and about how letting go of her long and happy relationship was, quote, a dagger to my heart. Many of my dearest relationships were tied to the SBC, and though most of them would survive the shift, at least to some degree, we no longer share the same bond. The leaving came with a dying. Keith and I mourned and wept for a long time. I didn't have a home church, didn't have a clue where to go. Her all knotted up life. She writes on page 118, quote, from where I sit, where I stand, where I walk, where I run, where I rest, where I pray and play and weep, my story looks like a shirt too long left in the bottom of a clothes hamper. Were I to bleach and launder it, starch and iron it, to stand up properly, crisp and straight, it would look a whole lot better, but I'm certain of this, it would no longer fit. Which leads me to this tendency. I want now to describe three detangling dynamics that have helped her in her all knotted up journey. Three strengthening, stabilizing, joy-bringing, beauty-producing, grace-saving realities that to me just ring out, shout out, call out loudly in her book that have been the source of strength and hope in her life. And I believe that these are three things that we, TNC, can enjoy, embrace, and experience in our own knotted up lives. And when you read this book, you might say, hey, I only saw two, or I only read four, or I read five or six, but what I want to do is just mention three. And in the process, strongly advocate for them in our own lives. I'll call them three saving graces for the all knotted up life. And first saving grace is the voices you listen to. The voices you listen to, because part of the knotted up life that we all live is hearing, responding, and dealing with an invading barrage of voices that speak into our lives. The voices of parents, grandparents, siblings, children, friends, teachers, denominations, politicians, books, TV, social media, and also our internal voices speaking to us of guilt, shame, confusion, worry, longing, hopes, and dreams. This is why Beth Moore says, quote, we have to let truth scream louder to our souls than the lies that have infected us. It's about the voices you listen to and the voices you believe. Because almost always, TNC, the voice you believe will determine the future you experience. It reminds me of many years ago when I read the novel The Brothers K by David Duncan. The book is about a family of baseball lovers, including Papa Chance, a mill worker who had hoped to be a professional baseball player, but he never made it, but he still loved to tell the boys stories about baseball. And at one point, he tells his sons about Ted Williams, the great batting champion for the Boston Red Sox, and he tells them about how Ted Williams knew where the strike zone was. It's, quote, wherever the umpire says it is. The strike zone exists only inside the umpire's head. Ted Williams knew this, and even though he would not usually give interviews, he finally granted an interview to a reporter, and he answered all the reporter's questions truthfully, except for one. How do you hit so well, Ted? At which point, Williams told the reporter that it was because he studied pitchers and that his own concentration and mechanics and bat speed, yes, that helped too. But then Williams said this, quote, everybody knows that there are quick wrists and slow wrists, but not many know that there are quick and slow eyes too. And my eyes are the key to my hitting. They're my secret weapon because my eyes are so quick, I can see any pitch, even a fastball, from the moment it leaves the pitcher's fingers all the way to where it jumps off my bat. And Papa Chance reminded his sons that it was the era in history where everybody read the newspaper every day. Papa Chance says, quote, umpires read the papers too, just like everybody else. And they read the words of Ted Williams, and they bought him. And boys, the next season, Williams' strike zone shrank 1 square foot, and if Williams didn't swing, the umps assumed that his quick eyes had seen that it was high or low or in or out. The plate's corners disappeared because no ump wanted to challenge Williams' eyes that didn't see a white blur, but saw 108 scarlet stitches on 4 fat white cheeks. And the next season was the season that Ted Williams hit 400, all because Williams' eyesight was good, but his ability to shape reality for the umpires was, quote, downright splendid. I love that story because his voice was believed, and the voice you believe will determine the future you experience. Actually, this reminds me of the story in Genesis chapter 2, where one voice says, the whole garden is yours. Eat from any tree you want, except just one. But another voice says, nah, I wouldn't listen to that voice. Adam and Eve hear two voices, and it's the voice they listen to that end up determining the future they experience. And the prophet Isaiah knows this too, makes this exact point in chapter 55, speaking to a people who have followed other gods. They've listened to other voices, and God, through Isaiah, invites them back to the source of real life. Listen, verse 1, come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters. And you who have no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk, without money and without cost. Isaiah is using a metaphor here, TNC, saying, if you are thirsty in life, if it's an all knotted up life, you can still come to God and receive his gifts of mercy and love and wisdom for free, and you don't have to ever pay anything back. It's no strings attached. Verse 2, and this is where we start talking about voices, the voices you hear. Verse 2, listen, listen, listen to me and eat what is good, and you will delight in the richest of fare. Verse 3, give ear and come to me. Listen to my voice that you may live. Because the voice you believe will determine the future you experience. This is why Beth Moore writes, we must let truth scream louder to our souls than the lies that have infected us. And now, let's just be honest, TNC, most of us, we never actually stop to think about the voices speaking into our lives. We don't, as the Apostle Paul counsels in 2 Corinthians, take every thought captive. Instead, what we do is we spend a lot of time getting worried because of the voices of that political news source telling us that the other party or policy or person is trying to steal my freedom. And we spend a lot of time getting anxious because that family member speaking to me is driving me crazy. Or that friend, every time they call or see me, they're just sucking the life out of me. And we spend a lot of time letting coworkers make us miserable. And we spend a lot of time letting social media guide our interests and feelings. And again, often the challenge is our own inner voice speaking lies to us. But Beth Moore reminds us in this book that the voices of truth are the ones that will help detangle the knots. It's about the voices you listen to. And so just imagine for a second that you could capture all the sound that you've taken in like the last 7 days. And then imagine you could separate it by source, graph it out, and evaluate it. What voices are you most listening to just by volume? By amount, including how much are you listening to this voice, the voice of the one who says, "You are my beloved child. I've called you by name. You're wonderful in my sight. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Nothing can separate you from my love. My grace is sufficient for you. My strength will come into your weakness. Death even has no ultimate sting because I'm promising you I have overcome death." The wonderful promises of these scriptures, TNC. And this is a major reason she has been able to live an all knotted up life with grace and faith and joy. It's the voices she most listens to. And this is my and your first saving grace for our all knotted up lives. The voices we most listen to, which leads to a second saving grace for the all knotted up life. First, the voices you listen to. Second, it's the church you lean into. In fact, trust me, don't read the book if you don't want to consider how the church needs to be a greater part of your life. Because over and over and over again, Beth Moore describes her love for the church and in detail how the church helped her get through so many tough times in her life, how the church celebrated with her victories, grieved in her losses, gave her a family of faith and a sense of continuity when nothing else did, connected her with a larger faith tradition, even stemming back not just years, but centuries and millennia. She felt a part of a whole movement across history. She loved leaning into the strength of the well-tested rituals, the old hymns, communion, baptism, prayer groups, Bible study groups. This book is a compelling case for the church, and I'll let you read it. But I will say this, that one of the dangers of even a podcast-driven church or a video screen church or an online church is this illusion. And it is an illusion that an individual can actually be healthy apart from a community. It's just simply not true, Beth Moore says. Actually reminds me of something John Calvin writes in his Institutes, pulling from Paul's language in Galatians chapter 4. Calvin writes, "One can no longer have God for his father who has not made the church for his mother." Because the purpose of the church is to be family. It's not to develop Christians who have almost exclusively a personal relationship with God, personal spiritual growth, and private intimacy with God at the loss of togetherness. In fact, I don't actually know anyone who would say this in any other area of life. Like, I have a great marriage. I spend my time with my spouse via video. And I love hanging out with my kids remotely, giving them hugs and support once a month from a distance. And the life of faith is not primarily about my individual connection to God, she says. It is instead about God calling, forming, saving, and redeeming a whole people in order to be a body, a community through which the world is infused with the love and the vision of Jesus for peace and justice and beauty and truth. Now, of course, this does not mean the church is perfect. Far from it. But it does mean that we need each other. And one of the themes of this memoir is the challenge for us and the question for us. Are you engaging and bringing your skills, wisdom, gifts, love, health, money, relationships to the church? Because every knotted up life needs a Jesus-centered church, she says. Which leads to the third saving grace for the all knotted up life. First saving grace is the voices we listen to. Second saving grace is the church we lean into. And third saving grace is the Jesus we love. Moore writes, to know Jesus is to love him. And to love him is to long for him. And to long for him is to reach for the one true thing we need. And she talks so powerfully about this when she describes her decision to leave the Southern Baptist denomination. Now listen, because for her, this was a choice to choose Jesus over a denomination. And it's not that she didn't do all she could first within the denomination to reach out and to talk and to pray and to consider and to evaluate. It's just that it became clear to her that staying was in fact endorsing things in complete opposition to the ways of Jesus. She writes, quote, when pro-Christian starts to look less and less like Christ, something's gone off the rails. And then she challenges every reader, all of us, to cling less to our labels and to cling more to Jesus. And part of that means, I think, TNC, that we must meet with, learn about, read about, talk about, take steps of faith with Jesus. And I know that means wrestling with Jesus. We talked about that last week with that Peter Enns great book, Curveball. We must wrestle with the texts and the history and the implications and the applications. Every generation must struggle and wrestle with Jesus, his claims, his questions, and his call for kingdom of God living. We must wrestle with what it means to live out Jesus' beautiful vision of justice and beauty, freedom and truth, power and spirituality, relationships and family. Because if we don't wrestle and engage and learn and grow with Jesus, we do so at our own peril. And we'll end up following someone else's version of Jesus, a teacher's, a denomination's, a book's, maybe a politician's version, maybe a pastor's version of Jesus, or Twitter feed's version of Jesus, or even a mix of just a few of our favorite sources. But I'll tell you, you put this book down and you sense anew and you're convicted anew that our world needs Jesus more than ever. But we better do our best to understand the Jesus we need and be committed to avoiding fleeting, flexible, agenda-driven, and even cartoonish pictures of Jesus. You put this book down and you sense that Beth Moore is one who has tasted and seen, trusted and seen, lived with and loved and leaned into Jesus and found his grace and his goodness and anticipates, listen to this, that she has yet to arrive, that her journey with Jesus is and will continue to adjust and grow and adapt and expand for the rest of her life here and for all of eternity. And so, we live in a world that is all knotted up. And how can we best live in an all knotted up world, TNC? First, it's about the voices we most listen to. Second, it's about the church we lean into. And third, it's about the Jesus that we love. These are the saving graces of the all knotted up life. Let's pray. God, I pray now for every person listening, and I pray for the knots in their life, the confusions, the disappointments, the worries, the fears, the baggage, the doubts. God, will you give us greater freedom from these things? And may this life experience of Beth Moore in this book, I pray that it would help everyone listening lean into truer voices and lean into the support of church family and into the grace and the power of Jesus Christ. Now, TNC, may the Lord bless you and keep you. Make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. Turn his face towards you and give you peace. Amen.